It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today it's a special show from the city where you can eat in 127 languages and feast for $5 or $500. I'm talking New York. Gourmet Magazine invited us to kick off their Gourmet Institute weekend with a live show on the stage of the Duke Theater. Well, the weekend was all about the people who shaped the New York food scene, and that's what you're going to hear this hour. We have reality TV's newest star, Rocco DiSpirito, consummate super chef Danielle Blue, our own and Gourmet's own John Willoughby, showman restaurateur Drew Neporant, architect David Rockwell, and finally critiquing the restaurant with Gourmet's editor-in-chief and former critic Ruth Reichel. So stick around. A dynamite hour is coming up. But first, this.
Autumn in New York, why does it seem so inviting? In New York, it spells the thrill of first nighting. Glittering crowds and shimmering clouds in canyons of steel. They're making me feel I'm home. It's autumn in New York that brings the promise of new love. Autumn in New York is often mingled with pain. Dreamers with empty hands may sigh for exotic lands. It's autumn in New York. It's good to live it again. lovers that bless the dark on benches in Central Park. It's autumn in New York. It's good to live it again.
Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by Super Target. We have a special show today from New York City. Gourmet Magazine invited us to kick off their Gourmet Institute weekend. Now, the weekend was all about who shapes the New York food scene. We previewed the weekend with an evening of interviews on the stage of the Duke Theater on 42nd Street, just off Broadway. Now, picture this. A small theater, the house lights come down to total darkness, and then a single pool of light comes up on stage. There are three stools and some microphones. And that's where the fun started. This hour, you are going to hear about the New York restaurant scene from the inside out. We have The Restaurant is Reality TV, what it takes to become a chef of a great restaurant, how a restaurateur and designer shape the restaurant, and finally, the life of the restaurant critic from one of the most theatrical ones we know. So let's roll. Now, the first person who joined me on stage is known in the business as the food writer's food writer. He's author of award-winning books with his pal Chris Slazinger. He's written for a laundry list of national outlets. He's a regular on The Splendid Table. And his latest gig is executive editor of Gourmet Magazine. I'm talking about John, also known as Doc Willoughby.
First of all, let's back up. What in heaven's name is the Gourmet Institute?
Well, this is the first Gourmet Institute, so we're going to find out this weekend what it is. What it is, really, is we decided that we wanted to take advantage of the incredible resources that we have here in New York. So we have assembled an amazing number of chefs, top chefs, restaurant designers, restaurant critics, food writers, mm-hmm. and our own staff. And what we're going to do is explore the world of American food as it exists in 2003.
So give me some examples of the kinds of specifics that are going to be happening.
Well, one of the things we're going to do is we have never let anybody into the gourmet test kitchens before. And partly that was just a matter of practicality. We used to be in an old building with a small kitchen and really couldn't. Mm-hmm. Now we have 8 test kitchens. Each food editor has their own test kitchen so that when they're testing recipes, they're doing it just like you would at home in their own little kitchen. And we're going to let people in there to see the test kitchens, to work with the food editors, to taste and test. We're going to show them how we do food photography, how we make the food look beautiful, mm-hmm. Food styling in our food, in our studio. So there's going to be all that behind the scenes about how Gourmet Magazine gets put together.
And I think people are going to really be surprised at how many times sometimes you have to do a recipe to nail it.
I was surprised when I got the magazine. It's unbelievable. But it's worth it, you know. Yeah. And plus, every time they do it, we get to taste it, so that's a good thing, too.
So who are the chefs who are going to be cooking? Because there's going to be a lot of cooking demos,
right? There's going to be a ton of cooking demos. We have 50 chefs.
In 48 hours,
in 48
right?
hours, yeah.
This is just Saturday and Sunday.
There are 4 concurrent events going on all the time. There's a tasting and testing going on in the kitchen. There is going to be a panel of experts talking about various things in the world of food.
Uh-huh.
Almost every top chef in New York is going to be there demonstrating what makes their food great.
You know what I loved? I peeked at the list, I have to tell you. But what I loved was Marcus Samuelson, who is a very gifted chef, but it's what's happening in the United States. I thought this was a little micro example. He is born in Ethiopia, raised in Scandinavia, and he's going to be demonstrating new sushi.
Right. This is perfect. This is what's going on in food.
This is the
in
United States.
Exactly.
This is, you know, you're not going to necessarily find that in Italy these days.
No, I don't think so.
So who's bought the tickets? How many people, first of all, and who's bought the tickets?
Well, we're restricting it to 300 people because the idea is we don't want people to be in in a big auditorium, seeing a chef down there, you know, Ducasse or someone down there demonstrating mm-hmm. something. From a distance, we want to be right next to them. So there'll only be 30 people at these chefs' demonstrations, so you can
stop them
and ask them what they're doing and actually learn something.
Is this sort of the latest thing for magazines? I know Food and Wine, you should pardon the expression, started years ago with the Aspen thing, but is this the thing that is being done, these gatherings?
Well, I think you're going to see them more and more. There's so many resources now to do them that they can be so worthwhile that really it's worth the time of the magazines to organize them to do them.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to learn a lot, too. You know, we also are going to be going to these demonstrations and participating and learning from the people who come, you know, what's going on where they live. So it's a very fertile ground for information to be exchanged.
John, thank you.
Thank you.
Good to see you. You know, John's one of the most modest people I know, but I have to tell you, this guy has just about done it all, and every time he does it, he's either winning awards or he's being pointed out as one of the real stars. Well, now I would like you to welcome the chef of Union Pacific Restaurant and the man who has broken new ground, the first reality TV show about a restaurant. I'm talking about Rocco Di Spirito. Rocco? I have to make a confession. I'm a little nervous with you.
Really? Don't be.
No, I just think, you know, now what you have done in terms of this show has, as we were just
saying. Or
what
it did to me, more to the point.
We watched you go through on the restaurant. Well, I would say the only thing that didn't happen...
You feel pretty sorry for me, right?
Well, in a way, yeah.
You should.
I mean, it seemed to be the only thing that didn't happen were locusts and the plague.
That's the next season, yeah.
Is that the next... There's going to be more.
There's going to be more,
oh,
yeah.
Oh, brother. You worked with the producer who started the Survivor series.
Mark Burdett is the guy who produced
this
show.
And I mean, he came to you and said, this is what we want to do.
Him and Ben Silverman, who's the exec producer, came to us and said, we want to do this, we think it's great, everyone loves restaurants, and... You know, I didn't know if it was a good thing or not, but I thought, you know, I'm a guy who takes risks, so let's roll the dice, you know. And I was opening Rocco's, coincidentally, right around the same time. And, you know, I didn't see a reason not to. I think what we do is really interesting, and I can't tell you the amount of times I've said, I wish there was a camera here, because no one would believe what I'm seeing, what I'm hearing, what I'm doing right now, because, you know, stuff, it just gets crazy in the restaurant business.
Now it is real. Right,
but it's how pretty, real? Pretty
is,
real, yeah.
Yeah, I
it's
mean, how real is the reality? I guess. Do you worry about looking foolish? Because I mean,
I look foolish every day of my life, you know. So now more people know about it. What's the big deal? If you're someone who's out there running a business, you're bound to look foolish several times a day. So everybody looks foolish. What's the big deal?
So
you know, in the end, I think what people will see is a pretty true representation of who I am. You know, I'm a mean chef sometimes, and I'm a, you know, a sympathetic manager sometimes, and I'm a coach sometimes, and I'm a businessman other times, and I think the show portrayed it pretty evenly. You know, there are a couple things in there that I thought I would love to have taken out, but since I don't edit the show, I couldn't do that.
Well, I read that you had said that the real theme behind the restaurant TV show was about family shame.
Well, it was one of the themes that was explored in the show. Yeah, I mean, I think... Common to many first and second generation children of immigrants is this sort of ethnic self-loathing that we're born with. You know, you grow up feeling ashamed of the fact that your parents don't speak the language that your teachers speak, or that they didn't go to school to the degree that other people's parents did. You know, my mom didn't know what the SATs were when time came to take them. So, you know, we were on our own a lot when it came to that kind of thing. You know, in the end, it's all made me who I am, and I'm happy I went through it because now I have this wonderful duality of cultures to draw from and create a whole new thing.
But you've done that with two restaurants, because I think what a lot of people don't fully appreciate about you is you've been very successful with a restaurant that's completely different from Rocco. Can you tell us, how did that come about? What is Union Pacific about?
Union Pacific is a restaurant that I opened in 1996 with a couple of people who wanted to bring to bear everything we loved about the East and the West and what, you know, lies between. And so we opened UP, and it's a fine dining restaurant that is all about flavor and flavor combinations, and recognizing that there are four flavors out there, and how you put them together is what makes food really interesting. So the food and the environment there are all about sort of an eclectic mix of things coming together to form a new whole, a synergy.
Yeah, because I remember dining there, and I remember Kobe beef, Japanese,
right,
with a sauce that, if I'm remembering correctly, tasted more France than Asia, but it worked. I mean,
yeah.
This part of you being Italian-American?
No, see, here's the thing. I think if I didn't grow up Italian-American in the neighborhood I grew up in, Jamaica, Queens, which probably has 100 different ethnicities per block, I wouldn't have been so open in terms of my culinary adventures. I think the reason that I have such a wide palate, so to speak, is because by the time I was 12, I had tasted food from India, Japan, China, Greece, Italy.
Mm-hmm.
And then at home, obviously, I was being cooked fresh food every single night. You know, restaurant was actually a bad word in my house growing up. You know, we weren't allowed to eat at restaurants. We weren't allowed to eat at McDonald's. We weren't allowed to eat, you know, processed foods, candy, Coca-Cola, none
of
that
was allowed. Did your family raise its own food?
My grandmother actually had about a 5-acre home in Long Island, and she raised her own chickens, her own pigeons, grew 40 kinds of produce, had 2 cherry trees, 2 fig trees, pear trees, apple trees, made her own wine, her own preserves, her own bread, and so she lived life like you do in Italy. Yeah.
And now people try to earn their millions so that they can go and do that.
Exactly. Yeah,
exactly.
Tenement farming.
Exactly. Ah, to be a peasant.
Exactly.
Yeah.
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 So we still, right?
Yeah.
Grass is always greener.
So just to go backwards for 1 minute, because there's a lot of material I want to cover with you, young man, now that I've got you here. On the restaurant, I was fascinated by your help. I mean, they were auditioning.
Which one of them?
Yeah, well, the guy who broke
They're all pretty fascinating, don't you think?
Yeah, they really.
So,
So when the camera stopped rolling, did they stick?
Many of them left the day after. The day after. Many of them we fired the day after. I think the people who were there for the cameras made it very obvious right from the beginning. And so, but there are, 10 or 15 people remaining from the original cast, so to speak.
Yeah.
And that's about normal.
You've got a new book. First book, isn't
My
it?
My first book,
Your first book. Yeah. Tell me about it.
It's called Flavor, and it basically explores what I think is not covered enough in cookbooks. It's a classic cookbook divided up by appetizers, soup, salads.
Uh-huh.
It's got 120 very well-tested recipes, all tested at home by home cooks with ingredients from a supermarket. I learned a lot about testing, is that it always comes out a different way every time.
Mm-hmm.
So, but part of the book is to encourage you to recognize that it will come out differently every time, and that's fine. And that's something you should actually embrace. And finding your sort of inner chef and what flavors make you happy. So I sort of try to give you the tools.
And what are the tools?
Well, first of all, understanding the basic flavors like primary colors. There are primary flavors, sour, salt, sweet, bitter. Of all the millions of ingredients out there, those are the 4 flavors that your palate recognizes. There's umami, and I address umami in the book. And
umami is that? Can you define it?
The 5th flavor, it's glutamates. It's basically what seaweed tastes like. MSG is a derivative of seaweed. Yeah. So I think that at home people have a limited knowledge of technique, have limited exposure to great ingredients, although much more now than ever before.
Yeah.
And equipment. Some people can afford the great pots and pans. Not everyone can. But everyone has a palate. And that, in fact, is your most important cooking tool. It's the one you need to use the most. And I just think that if you focus on your palate more than anything else, you'll be a much better cook.
I think I'm going to get a copy of the book, right?
Okay, thank you.
It sounds
just
great.
One?
All right, 2. Hey, thanks so much
You're
for
so
being
welcome.
With us.
It's great being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chef Rocco Bespirito is the award-winning chef of Union Pacific and Rocco's. His new book is Flavor. Coming up, Danielle Ballou on Becoming a Chef, how restaurants get their looks, and the life of a restaurant critic, all from Gourmet Magazine's Gourmet Institute weekend in New York City. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can visit them online at target.com/SuperTarget. Now, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to a special broadcast taped in New York City on the stage of the Duke Theater on 42nd Street. Gourmet Magazine invited us to kick off their Gourmet Institute weekend, which was all about the people who shape the New York food scene. Well, we invited some of them to join us on stage. The next person I talked with is one of the country's truly extraordinary chefs. He is Danielle Boulud.
Oh, this is such a pleasure. This man has given me more pleasure on the end of a fork than I can possibly begin to describe.
No, it's not that way.
Now, Danielle, you've done several cookbooks, but you've got a new book out, and the book is interesting because I haven't seen anything quite like this before. It's called Letters to a Young Chef.
Yes.
I've seen chefs' memoirs, but this is something more.
No, this is not about a memoir. Yeah, it's about, I was asked by Basic Book, we're doing a series on, it started with Rilke in, I guess, the turn of the century. And
Raya Maria Rilke, the poet.
Exactly, yeah. With Letter to a Young Poet. And then they took over and did a couple of different Letter to a Young Lawyer, Letter to a Young Architect. Mm-hmm. And they asked me, they say, would you like to write Letter to a Young Chef? And I didn't know much about what it was about, but I did like the idea and the subject, and I researched and I worked, and I felt, and that was a very good thing to be able to communicate, because I live with them every day in the kitchen. I mean, they are with me, they are driving me crazy sometimes, but I'm also, they are definitely giving me so much pleasure at the same time.
But also, it's become something now that we have celebrity chefs.
I'm not going to Hollywood. I'm staying on the Upper East Side, but Rocco looked good tonight.
Yeah, he did.
I think he's a great guy. He really looked good. He has a personality, and I think he can really cook too. So that's great. He's got a great combination.
But it's this combination that I think is appealing to a lot of people who want to start out in the restaurant business.
No. It's a mix. I think it's like music. You have to be inspired. You have to look up on someone who is definitely a master at it. Mm-hmm. Some kids are dreaming to be the next Thomas Keller, Charlie Trotter, or Danielle Boulud.
Well, what kind of person do you have to be a chef?
You have to have a very good palate, of course, to be a good chef. Uh-huh. I think you have to have the passion to... you have to be born with a passion to cook, definitely. From a very often very young age. Some people by education get into the kitchen. And like me, it was really because from very young, I was very interested by it. And I started in a very good restaurant. And I think it's important, I think, as a young chef to definitely understand the discipline and the drive you're going to have to go through to succeed. And also, in America, for me as a French chef, I only had to learn French cuisine, I guess, then at the time. Mm-hmm. But today for a young American chef, I think is a much broader thing to do, including also for a young French chef today to learn much more than just French cuisine. So it's maybe a little bit more hard at the beginning to focus on what you're going to want to do. I think it's important for a young chef to focus and to really stay in line with what is really the past is choosing.
During your apprenticeship and afterward, you went from one very good restaurant to another. How do you make that happen?
Well, I started in two-star restaurant in Lyon, which was one of the best restaurants of the town. And I was very lucky and very humble, I think. It's very important to understand that as a very young chef, you get humiliated, and you definitely get worked out hard. And, of course, it's very competitive often between cooks, as you are the youngest.
Yeah.
You are the one who pick up everything. It's like in a family with the kids, you know. If you're the last one, you're kind of the one who has to do all the dirty jobs sometimes. And so I learned to overcome all this, but at the same time, I learned amazing things with some chefs who work in some amazing restaurants in the past, like Fernand Point and Dumaine, which were great chefs of France. From that, I was lucky to go to Georges Blanc, who at the time didn't have 3 stars, but yet was driven to get them. So it's sometimes very, very passionate. It's very interesting to see the passion and the drive for a restaurateur or a chef to succeed, to try to gain something and succeed, I think.
Are you constantly, I gather through this process, you're constantly developing contacts, and that's one of the ways you go from one place to the next.
It's very important for a young chef to use the mentor, I mean, the person he worked for as a springboard for the next job, because it's nothing worse than to investing yourself to someone and giving everything you have, and yet leave and close the door behind. I think it's important for young chefs to really make a good mark at the start, and they can really use that also to be recommended.
Well, at this point, Danielle, you have several restaurants. You are considered one of the greatest chefs in our country and one of the great chefs of the world. So what's next?
Well, there's always something next. I think if I had the drive to do what I've done so far, I'm still driven to do more. I was approached to design my own line of pots and pans, knife, kitchen tools, and things like that. And I feel it's very interesting. Mm-hmm. And so merchandising will be certainly my next excitement right now. But that's not taking me away from the kitchen, so that's good.
Danielle, thank you so much
thank
for being
you,
with us. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Now let's learn how a restaurant gets its look and its feel. Now, we're going to be joined by two of the best in the business. We have Drew Neporant, who is showman come restaurateur. He has 15 establishments that are in his Myriad restaurant group, and with him is going to be architect David Rockwell. Now, David is the president of the award-winning Rockwell Group. Gentlemen. Welcome, you two. Welcome. I should tell you, you know what? I'm not going to tell you. I'm going to get into it with David. Because, David, I'd like to talk to you first. Excuse me, Drew. I know you love the theater. And I know one of your credits is having done, is it sets for the Rocky Horror Picture Show, among other things? And you've got the sets for a show that's now opening here in New York?
Hairspray.
A little show called Hairspray.
Yeah. Hairspray.
We should have restaurants that sell that many tickets.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But how do you get to the restaurant from this? Or is it a logical move?
It was sort of the other way around. My early on love was theater. My mother was in theater. I was brought up in a family that did community theater. For uh-huh. anyone who's seen Waiting for Guffman, it was a little bit like that. As I remember when I was 11, I came into New York to see Fiddler on the Roof, which was my first show, standing room only. And we went to Schraff's. And it was the first time I remember just being blown away by a restaurant and the ability for the physical environment to change how you feel about the food. And it just evolved. So theater was a love. Restaurants became my business, architecture. And then recently I got back into theater, which has just been thrilling.
So you've come sort of a full circle,
right,
in a way. Well, now, Drew, why David for you? Because you two have worked on quite a few projects.
Well, David must have called me about 1,000 times. David must have thought that I had 2 of the ugliest restaurants in the world and he was going to design a really good one. Now, you know, I give David a lot of credit. I really didn't know him, and we just started a phone conversation, and then, in fairness, David redesigned the Vong space, right? It was already an Italian restaurant, but he adapted it to Vong, which was an incredible job.
Maybe you should explain a little bit about what Vong was.
Well, Vong is owned by John George Vongerichten, and it's his Vietnamese Thai restaurant. And David's work on that was phenomenal. And we were talking to this fellow, Nobu Matsuhisa, from Japan.
That guy.
That guy from California, really. And I just said, God, I got to get Rockwell off my back. I better throw the dog a bone, you know, just like, no. Well, we met. We actually had lunch at an interesting restaurant. And then it all fit. I like, you know, David from the get-go. He's completely unpretentious. And I think with Nobu, what I was trying to achieve was something unpretentious and something lacking all the cliches that you would typically see in a Japanese restaurant. And David, you know, just really synergized perfectly with that aspiration.
Drew, how do you make your mark felt when working with someone like David? Because both of you have such strong imaginations.
Well, his job is to please the client.
Ah.
At least it was. At least it was. Now it's to get paid.
I remember. Remember on Vong, Drew's first comment was, after we did Vong, we'd like you to do Nobu, but we want to make sure it doesn't look like Vong.
Right.
And it's an interesting dilemma in the design business that what you really want to do is take the personality of the chef and the operator and turn that into an environment that balances with the food. And I said, well, I've never done anything before that looked like Vong. Why would anything afterwards that looked like it?
Right. And you know, it's always funny. It's like when you collaborate on design, I always say, I don't care if it's green, white, red, or blue.
Right.
I just need it to be operationally sound. And Nobu specifically, the first rendering, let's just say, the sushi bar was all the way in the back. And I specifically told David, I said, no. When the door opens, you want that sushi bar between this pillar and this pillar, and it's like center stage. And then we had the banquettes up on a riser. And Nobu himself, when he came in and looked at some of the things, said, absolutely not. I want this thing to be, you know, because when people drink, they might fall down, they might trip. So David called me afterwards, and he said, listen, this is really important. We need this level. I said, Nobu's going to forget about it. Just go ahead and do whatever you need to do. So Nobu walked into the place when the risers had been put in. And there's an expression I can't use on radio, what he did to me, and the risers were no longer there.
Uh-huh, yes.
So Nobu actually collaborated on Nobu also, can you imagine?
Well, this is what I wonder. I mean, you said the function is important, but what drives the restaurant design? Is it the food, or does the design start to affect the food?
Well, it's truly a collaboration. I mean, and that's what's so, from a design point of view, so thrilling about it, is you're actually in real time collaborating with a chef, with an operator, and it's not about how the walls are decorated.
Mm-hmm. It,
as Drew said, the color is the last thing you look at. You look at the flow. If you look at the analogy of theater and you think about in theater, the curtain comes up and an actor comes out and they tell you what their story is. They come from their world into your world. There's a real transition. In restaurants, you have the same thing. When you enter, you're given a whole set of visual clues, and our job is to create an environment that works for the first five people who walk in the restaurant,
right.
Which is a challenge. 150-seat restaurant with the first five people that doesn't feel overwhelming, works when it's full. It's a living, breathing organism, and it's just as important from a design point of view to figure out how to design it so the food gets to the table hot, than to come up with a great color scheme, to figure out how the sound isn't deafening, to figure out how you can, you know, get the right amount of service stations.
And you're not going to believe this, but people actually used to go to restaurants for food.
And
I always say it's the steak and it's the sizzle. And what happened when people like David started designing restaurants and becoming popular, there was a wow factor. And think about it, like when you go to a restaurant and you've never even tasted a morsel of food, but you open the door and it's like, wow, I got to take somebody here. And this is before you've eaten anything.
Yeah.
So, you know, to people like ourselves who are very paranoid and, you know, it's a very competitive field, we need every edge that we possibly can get. So guess what? We market not only the chef, but we market the designers now.
Well, the room.
It's a Rockwell design, you know.
I think that term, the room, I mean, you hear this now where people will say, I really want to go there because the room is great. And we didn't hear that a decade ago.
No, but a decade ago, it was still important to design a room where people looked great. I mean, a decade
exactly.
ago it was done yeah. because there were 20 chandeliers and lots of multiple lighting sources and people looked great if you go to an old classic dining room. Now, when you're, you know, creating new environments, you still have to figure out how to solve those basics, make the food look good, make people look great, make it so people can move through it gracefully.
David, does we hear this constantly now about design. Does feng shui ever work into your designs at all?
Well, I will tell you that I think it's as reasonable as anything else. You know, it's not something that we have a lot of experience in.
Uh-huh.
Except for we did a restaurant called Town for Jeffrey Zakarian in this new hotel, a small 25-foot wide space, down 18 feet from the street, so a very challenging space. You had to get people to come in and move down into it. And he brought in a feng shui master who worked with us on it. And based on the success, I've got to say I'm a believer. And recently for Grey Coons, we're doing a restaurant that opens up in February, and we've been working with a feng shui master on it. And, you know, who am I to say?
You know, I'm wondering about the things that diners, we usually don't ever think about, like how a chair feels, or the feel of the silverware, or, well, you know, everybody talks about the restrooms, but light, sound, you alluded to some of them. I mean, what about those things that we never think about? How do you think those out? How do they play?
Well, I think attention to detail is important, but I think it actually used to be more important. I think currently we're in a phase of the dining, at least I see it in New York, where, it's more the mood than the food.
Uh-huh.
And the mood versus, you know, the all those infinite details. And quite frankly, I think people like David Rockwell have been successful because there was so much money spent on bad design and pretentious design. What people thought, for instance, hotel dining spaces were all like ridiculously large chairs. Mm. You know, you have this huge round table, but you can only fit six chairs around it. And so, like, somebody said, oh, we're seven now, and then you have to, like, figure out you can't seat them at that table because these chairs are actually, you know, 32 inches wide instead of 18 inches wide. So there's a lot of small factors. I think, personally, every time we set out to do a restaurant, we want to err on behalf of the customer. And it's not always just about comfort, like a comfortable chair, because sometimes you actually, you know, what you think is a comfortable chair, like armchairs.
Right.
You know, I used to weigh 335 pounds. I don't like my legs together, you know. Just the arms are pushing them, so I like something a little bit different. But great design is subliminal. Great design just happens.
Interesting. A question for both of you. Have you ever done a restaurant that the design just didn't work?
I was worried you were going to ask that question.
Yeah, I figured you would be. But
well, this wasn't David's.
You were right.
This wasn't David's fault, but I had this incredible idea to do the Berkeley Bar and Grill.
I've got to go now.
And, you know, if you put your finger in the map of Manhattan, you wouldn't want to be in a more perfect location off of Madison Avenue in the 50s in the corporate headquarters of a great, you know, music company. And David and I collaborated on it, and I was very stubborn about certain things. But it was it's probably in the only mall in the middle, in Midtown, you know. But you know what's interesting about things?
Uh-huh.
You're in a space normally during the day when you're talking about all these design ideas. But after five, you're typically not in that space. So when you finally open the restaurant and adjust the lighting and realize that you have this like unbelievably ugly lighting emanating from the mall into your space, and it throws everything off, and it's a weird thing. It never gets back on track. But
and it was a case where you couldn't control your destiny. You were sort of trapped in a space and couldn't control the whole experience, which is challenging.
Yeah, and so I wouldn't blame it on design, but I would blame it on a lot of things, but creatively, it was a cool place.
So it sounds like control is really is the key here.
Yes.
Some people say it's an illusion.
Oh, control is everything in life.
Yeah. Well, hey. And we all pray one day
that's
we
my
will
fault.
Have it. David Drew, thanks for being with us.
Lynn, thank you.
Real pleasure. I'm now going to look at restaurants very differently. Take care, guys.
Druni Porant heads up the Myriad Restaurant Group. Architect David Rockwell is president of the Rockwell Group. Well, coming up, the story behind a dream job, the real life of a restaurant critic with Ruth Reichel. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to a special edition of The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target store all in one, where you can have your cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at Target.com/SuperTarget. Okay, back to New York City and Gourmet Magazine's gathering of the folks who shape the food scene there, the Gourmet Institute weekend. Now, we were recording at the Duke Theater with a live audience. Our last guest to join us on stage represents perhaps the most powerful person in the restaurant world, the one who can make or break a new establishment. The restaurant critic. We turn to a woman who's done it all. She's been a chef, a newspaper food editor, best-selling author, restaurant critic for two of the country's most prestigious papers, the LA Times and the New York Times. And now she has this other little job, editor and chief of Gourmet Magazine. I'm talking about Ruth Reichel.
Hello, darling. All right, I lust after your necklace. Ruth has this wonderful bold gold chain with a locket. Is it hanging?
Yeah. Where's your family from in Italy?
Yeah, you got
this
it.
This is Sicily.
Is that Sicily?
It's Sicily.
You know, for the longest time, I was the only woman when I was working in Italy researching. I was the only woman in the marketplace in the morning who wasn't wearing the family, you know, Fort Knox around the neck or the fur coat.
Exactly.
My cousin Delfina, just so that nobody should, you know, not know about the affluence that the family has gained, goes on her bicycle to the market every morning wearing her fur coat and her pink pearls. And I love her dearly.
That's how I want to go to market.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, Ruth, I want to talk about a past life.
Okay, which one would that be?
I'm not going to get tacky about this, I promise. So I want to talk about restaurant reviewing because when you talk to people who are really into food, like the people who are coming, you know, to the event this weekend, I would say the two jobs they think are the most glamorous, being a chef and being a restaurant reviewer.
Okay, and they're right about half of it.
Which half?
Being a restaurant reviewer. I mean, being a chef is incredibly hard work. And you're on your feet and it's hot.
Yep.
And you work ridiculous hours. Being a restaurant critic is truly a fabulous job. I did it for 23 years, and I never got beyond this sense of, I can't believe I'm getting away with this.
But, you know, I wonder about something, because I approach a lot of meals as though it's Christmas morning. Do you lose that delight?
You don't. Well, I think it depends. And, you know, if you're a good restaurant critic and you lose the delight, you leave the job, because you can't do the job well if it's not fun. Mm-hmm. I mean, nobody wants to read about somebody's experiences in restaurant if you don't have a good time doing it, if you have no enthusiasm for the food. And, you know, I am sort of a Pollyanna kind of person, but the truth is that I still, and the entire time that I was doing it, went in saying to all my friends, this one's really going to be great. Wait till you get this meal is going to be fabulous. And it was always incredibly disappointing when it wasn't. And then what you have fueling your review, if it's not good, is that anger of, why wasn't this better?
You know, how did you let me down?
Great. Exactly. Yeah.
But you usually go back several times, right?
Many times. As a responsible critic, you wouldn't go to any restaurant fewer than three times. If you're a restaurant critic who has, you know, a lot of financial clout, if you're at the LA Times or the New York Times,
right.
I mean, you go eight times, nine times, 10 times. You go over and over and over again because you want to go lunch, dinner, small group, large group, weekend, weeknight. You figure that every restaurant has a terrible night, and you sort of want to be able to discount that. And, you know, you might go on the one night that it was really fabulous and they never get there again, and you don't want to let your readers down and, you know, tell them that
exactly.
This is going to be the greatest restaurant they ever went to and it was a fluke.
Do you feel there are ground rules that all restaurant critics should follow?
Well, I think that, you know, there are the basic ones, which are be fair, you know, go a number of times. Uh-huh. But I also think, you know, one of the things that a good restaurant critic does, and it's why I am so down on things like the Zagat reviews, which it seems to me you don't know who those people are. And
we maybe should explain how Zagat works.
Well, Zagat, people vote, and it can be thousands of anonymous people who, you know, check off these lists. Mm-hmm. And so you don't know what their tastes are. And I think a really good critic understands that this is very personal, that, you know, I have no idea if what I taste is the same thing as what you taste. And we all have different acuities for, uh-huh, for different
exactly,
flavors,
exactly.
And we come at it with different cultural bents. So my feeling always was that as a critic, you want your audience to get to know you. So that, you know, you're not giving them a truth that comes down from on high. You're not saying, you know, this is a great restaurant because I say so. You're saying, this is how I experience this restaurant, and this is who I am. And over time, even people who have a different taste than you do, your reviews are valuable for them because they understand that if you don't like something, they may very well like it.
Yeah, because they know they disagree.
Because they know they agree.
Like, is this why you also, I gather you go with different people? So are you actually trying to taste through their palate as
no,
well?
No, I always felt, and you go through different people because you want to eat everything on the menu, and if you don't take a lot of people, you're going to be going for months.
Or you're going to look pretty silly ordering the entire menu. Yeah,
right, yeah. I'd like the 12 appetizers and just bring them all and I'll taste through them. But no, I learned over time that the worst thing that can happen to you as a restaurant critic is to have people tell you what they think. I mean, my ground rules over time mm-hmm. were, you can come, you can order anything you want, but I don't mediate food fights. So if there are six people at the table and you want the lobster souffle, order it first. Because, you know, only one person can have it, but I'm not.
So you don't tell people what to order.
I don't tell people what to order. I mean, the rules are you get to order anything you want. You can eat as much as you want, but I, you know, claim it first. And then don't tell me what you think. Don't talk about the food. Don't say a word. You're here to have a good time. You're just a hired mouth. I am the person who is, you know, being paid for my opinion.
But speaking about eating all you want, what about weight? Do you ever gain weight? I mean, you're eating out constantly?
I have to tell you that if I ever decide that I really need to make a lot of money, I am going to write the book that is called The Restaurant Critic's Diet. Because what happens when you're a restaurant critic is you lose the obsession. In 23 years of reviewing restaurants, never gained a pound. And the secret of that is that when most people go to the restaurant, it's like you said, it's a holiday. Today I give myself permission to eat the 4 pieces of chocolate cake, and then if I'm still hungry, I'll have a chocolate sundae after that.
Mm-hmm.
As a restaurant critic, you get up in the morning knowing that you're probably going to have 3 professional meals that day, and that if you don't be very careful about how you eat, you're going to show up at your third meal uncomfortably full, and that's not fair. That is one of the things mm-hmm. that's fair is, you know, you really want to have an appetite when you go out to eat. And so gobbling up everything that comes your way is not a very good idea. And the other thing is that you know that wonderful as this meal is, there's another one coming tonight and tomorrow night.
And who knows what glories you want to be prepared for.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And also, there is something very different. If I take 4 people out to eat and I'm tasting all of their appetizers and all of their main courses and all of their desserts, that's an awful lot of tasting.
Mm-hmm.
And one or two tastes of each of those things is... It becomes fatiguing to both your palate and your mind, and you stop wanting to eat that much. I have to tell you that cooking for myself, I eat so much more because, you know, we're sitting at the table and we're relaxed and I'm not thinking about the food, and I've probably cooked something that I really wanted to eat, as opposed to the other thing of being the restaurant critic is you always end up ordering the weird thing that nobody else wanted. You know, the eel with chocolate sauce, that, you know, none of your friends want to order that. So you say, okay, somebody's got to taste this dish. I'll have that one. And at home, you know, I've made something that seems really good to me, and we're sitting around, and, you know, you have firsts, and then you're still talking, so you have a little more, and then you're still talking, and
eat a little more.
Eat a little more. So I eat probably four times as much when I'm just sort of in a relaxed way eating at home than I ever ate as a restaurant critic.
One of the things you gained a reputation for, and I loved reading your reviews, this was storytelling, was your disguises. How did the disguises come about? And could you explain them? Because I think a lot of people aren't aware of what you did.
Okay, well, I've always believed that one of the things that you have to do as a restaurant critic is be as anonymous as you possibly can. Because what you're trying to do is not only say, this is what my experience was, but as much as possible for your readers, this is the experience that you are very likely going to have. And, you know, if you go in and you're the New York Times, they're going to, no matter how many people are waiting in line, you're going to get the next table, and they're going to make, you know, five dishes, versions of that dish till the perfect one comes out for you. And so you really want to go and be everyman. And when I was at the LA Times, this wasn't a big problem. I just made reservations in other people's names, and it wasn't such a big deal. But after I had taken the job at the New York Times, before I came here, I was flying back and forth from LA to New York to do a lot of eating in New York before I started the job. And on my second visit, I got on a plane, and this woman looked at me, and she said, "Oh, I know who you are." And I looked at her and I said, "What are you talking about?" And she said, "I know that you're going to New York to eat." And I said, "You know, who do you think I am?" And she said, "I know you're Ruth Reichel, and you're about to be the restaurant critic of the New York Times." And I said, "How could you possibly know that?" And she said, "I work in a restaurant, and have a picture of you hanging in the kitchen, and the owners have offered $500 to anybody who spots you in the restaurant. So if you would be kind enough to tell me where you're going to eat tonight, I will go claim my restaurant." I'll go call
the restaurant.
You're
kidding. She actually did that?
She actually did that. And I sat there, you know, it's a 4.5 hour flight from LA to New York, and I sat there thinking, they're not going to get away with this. What can I do about this? And I thought, okay, if they have a picture of me and they know who I am,
right,
I'm not going to be that person. I'm going to be someone else. And I landed in New York, and I called a friend of my mother's who's an acting coach and said, "You have to help me do a disguise." And that's how they started.
The famous wear a hat.
No. This was not the famous wear a hat. This was... Claudia was a very meticulous acting coach, and she really made me sit down and say, okay, who are you going to be? Who is this person? Where does she live? What does she do for a living? How old is she? And we concocted the first disguise, whose name was Molly, and we figured out what she would wear. She would have a used Armani suit. So I went to a resale shop and got a used Armani suit, and we figured out what jewelry she would wear and what her hair would look like. And she had an entire persona.
Fun!
Well, I have to tell you that it was very strange, because the first time Claudia came with me for the first meal, which was at Le Cirque, and... as we were going out, I said, you know, what do you think Molly talks about? And Claudia said, that's what you're about to find out.
Ah.
And over time, as I developed more and more, before I was done, I had 13 different personas, and they each had their own charge cards and their own lives, and they were very different. And they each had different tastes. And
who was the most unlike you?
The most unlike me was Chloe. Chloe was a very soignée blonde, very proper. She wore a lot of makeup.
Uh-huh.
She had to have manicures, something I've never had. It was the first manicure I'd ever had in my life. She had to have long nails. And, you know, she actually had to go out and get new underwear because Chloe would not wear this sort of ordinary underwear that I wear. And she wore much higher heels than I've ever worn. And when Chloe went out, I mean, do blondes have more fun?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Cabs came screeching to a halt for this woman. You know, I would go out, I'd be waving my hand around, taxi, they'd ignore me completely.
You know, really, schizophrenia can pay. Ruth, thank you so much.
This was fun.
This was fun for us. You take care. I'll see you later.
Ruth Reichel is editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine. She's author of two autobiographical works, Tender at the Bone and Comfort Me with Apples. Well, that's our show from New York City. Thanks for being with us today, and special thanks to Gourmet Magazine and the Gourmet Institute for being such great hosts. Have a fine week, and remember what that grand dame, Mae West, said. Too much of a good thing is wonderful. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. This special broadcast was produced by Sally Swift and associate producer Jennifer Russell. Our technical directors were Jennifer Lubke and Nick Kariakis. Special thanks to the Duke Theater on 42nd Street and to Gourmet Magazine and the Gourmet Institute for their hospitality. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week. Join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.